Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 13. Coming up on the show, we've got Falconelli and the alchemical secrets of the atom, the lost city of the monkey god, and Planet X and the return of the Mayans. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
A very reasoned, scientific show coming up. Of course, that I couldn't let that happen, so I had to balance it out with the Mayans coming back to kill all of us!
Riding on Planet X?
Well, no, the Planet X has already been destroyed, allegedly by the Mayans.
Not according to Paul Seaburn on mysteriousuniverse.org last week.
Oh, God, that article.
He wrote the article with the headline, Kim Jong-un preparing to destroy Planet X. The basic premise was that Kim Jong-un is trying to build up his nuclear arsenal not to attack America or Japan.
And not to increase its political standpoint or anything like that at all.
No, he's actually preparing for the return of Planet X. He's gotten word from his advisors that it is real, it's coming back, and he wants to save the human race. And I immediately emailed Paul
and said, like, you're fired.
Well, no, well done, sir. That is genius.
No, I just joke. I love Paul's work.
Bonus Although, pay for you this month.
I must say, there were a number of people I had to ban off the Facebook page because there was the obligatory, that's fake news.
Oh, really? Of course it is. He wasn't advocating it. He was writing how stupid it was.
My favorite point is where people go, this used to be a scientific website, but now it's still... like, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? It's never been scientific in our lives.
I think the first article is you reviewing salt lamps, so not scientific.
Do you know what? I actually really regret writing that article because I really was, when I started Mysterious Universe, I was into salt lamps. It was kind of a phase I was going through. But now I keep on receiving all these spam emails from Sun Jeep from some salt mine somewhere saying that if you want to sell salt mines on your website, I can hook you up with some salt. And like, they're just constant. Yeah.
Poor
constant
Sun Deep's always got 2 tons of salt he's trying to get rid of. He's trying to contact us for wholesale.
The thing is, I put filters in and then they just change the email address.
Yeah, it's because it's always going to come up. The only way to get rid of it is to delete that article, but I think it's like, it's a classic in Mysterious Universe history.
Yeah.
Your salt lamp review.
That's like my legacy. That's my monument once I pass on from this mortal coil. I'll be known for salt lamps.
So what have we got coming up on this crazy show?
Well, actually, as I said, it's scientific and reasoned, but I was just looking around for an interview this week, actually, and I ended up coming across the book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. And I was going to contact the author, and I ended up just reading the book in itself. Mm. And I was really fascinated by it. It was very scientific, very logical. And because of that, I really did have to find something to balance it out with for Mysterious Universe.
Oh, I see. So when you're going into a book with the title The Lost City of the Monkey God, you presume that at the end of the book, there is going to be a lost city and there will be some kind of god monkey at the end.
Yes.
But you're saying that doesn't happen.
No, I won't give it away. But unfortunately, we don't come across a particular monkey god. We come across something far worse. But of course, you know, the shelf elves were out today. But as I walked into the office, I looked up the top of one of our bookshelves. And at the very top, we have all these tiny little books that I just randomly ordered that I never go through. And one just happened to be kind of just grabbing my attention. And I look up and it's The Mystery of the Ancients, Early Spacemen and the Mayans, The Staggering Saga of Earth's Most Sinister Secret. It's by Eric and Craig Umland. And wow, did that end up becoming one hell of a counterpoint, I suppose, to The Lost City of the Monkey God.
It sounds like a fun spin to add on to The Lost City of the Monkey God. And the weird thing is we've had this book in our library for, what, a couple of years now?
Oh, if not longer.
And just never looked at it,
right? Yeah, exactly. So, because they're so small that I just kind of ignore them. But I was really pleased that I found it because it's a nice, as I say, counterpoint to this very scientific and reasoned story.
Does it answer where the Mayans disappeared to?
Yes, it does.
Oh.
Yeah, it does.
Is it another dimension?
No, but according to the
is
story...
Is it the inner Earth?
Look, as crazy as this is, apparently they arrived on Earth about 190 million years ago.
Oh.
Back around the time of Gondwanaland, before Pangaea or just after Pangaea kind of broke up.
I think the timelines match up. It's a fairly remote age, but... Yeah. But it fits in with evolution.
There's a whole story, and it fits in, I guess, I mean, I don't want to say aliens, I can't believe I'm going there, but really it is. It's these ancient space miners, allegedly, according to Umland, that have been travelling around the galaxy, and they have come to Earth for specific reasons because we have specific metals that they want.
Oh.
And that's why you don't find any metal in these abandoned Mayan ruins that are all now, obviously, just left. But apparently, because modern archaeologists say, well, there's no metal, so they never had any ability to mine the metal, or they never reached a certain technological level. But according to Umland, the reason why we don't see any metal is because they took it when they left.
Okay.
Which makes sense. All right,
I'm strapped in for that. I felt like I was going fishing this week in terms of trying to find a cool story for the show. And you know those feelings where if you're a fisherman, you're just sitting down and nothing's biting. It felt like that all week until today. Actually, I was here really late last night till nearly midnight, just going through old websites and trying to find old books. And all the fish started biting at about 11:30
you know
p.m.
what?
Last night.
I think you and I need to stop actually doing all of our work throughout the week and just come into the office about an hour before we have to record.
That's what it feels
like. And that's where everything's there.
Dude, that's what it feels like. Everything just drops in your lap at 5 p.m. on a Friday night.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you have all this amazing content. So I started looking at the history of radionics.
Isn't radionics that like ability to increase the size of vegetables or something?
Yeah,
basically,
in a way that is tied in, yes. But it can all be traced back to a medical doctor in the early 1900s. And I won't do this today, but I just want to give you my thinking of where my thinking's been in the last couple of days.
Well, we'll do it on Tuesday.
Yeah, I've got all this stuff slowly cooking in the background. And he would use a percussive diagnosis on his patients. Have you ever heard of the percussive technique?
What is that?
It's where a doctor will usually hold their middle finger onto the abdomen of the patient and then they'll strike the finger and they're basically listening to the percussive sound.
Oh, and right. Yeah. And
I think it's still used today. And
it
tells you, or gives you a sense of what's going on underneath the flesh.
Yeah. Well, people looking for hernias, I think, can use it.
Yeah. So if you've got a hollow sound, usually it means it's okay. But if it's a dull tone, there might be some issues. And so he was an expert at this doctor. But one day he noticed that his patient was fine using this percussive technique, unless the patient was facing west. And then he thought, oh, that's strange. So he started to try and figure out why this was happening. He had an idea it might be due to the magnetic orientation of which way the guy was facing. So he started to develop machines. He started to hook his patients up to electrodes and all these funky machines in the early 1920s. And then other people went on from his ideas and developed their own machines and started hooking them up to two people at once and vegetables. And it eventually came to the point in the 1950s where companies were using their radionics machines to get rid of pests in fields of crops.
But I thought that was all based on junk science. Was this something that's kind of just never took off? Like there may have been something to it?
Well, that's what I thought as well. But a lot of the stuff was shut down by the feds.
Of course.
And well, it's fun to go into because there's all these conspiracy theories about the chemical companies shutting them down. The lobbyists for the chemical companies wanting to shut them down. So one of the examples was a company that was set up and basically they'd use their crazy radionics machines to, like I said, remove pests from a field of corn, for example. And what they'd do with that is they'd use aerial photography to take a photo of the field of corn.
Right.
And then that corn field could be states and states away in the US, the other side of the country. But they'd take that photo and they'd put it in their crazy radionics machine with all the knobs and dials and cables connected to it. And then they'd take a drop of pesticide and just bloop, drop it in the machine on the photograph. And then over a period of time, the farmers would report that miraculously all the pests had been removed from their fields.
Come on. So it's like some weird, like telepathy or...
It's all connected with orgone therapy and it's basically...
Oh, thank you, by the way, for sending me a picture of... You were describing the accumulator of orgone energy and then you just sent me a drawing of breasts. Thank you so much.
That all came because eventually, I mean, this all led to a whole bunch of inventions going on through the 1960s and 1970s. And even today, there's still people selling these products to farmers in Iowa and Pennsylvania and... If you look around online, there's a lot of people reporting that it actually works for them, which I found really fascinating. And you've got to, that goes into a deeper question of what's actually going on here. You can buy these crazy towers that you put on the end of your field of crops and then blast your crops with this crazy energy.
So was that drawing you sent me in regards to organ breast enlargement?
No, well, I'm really glad you asked that right at the start of the show on a topic that I wasn't going to do today. But it's from the book Rays from the Capstone by Christopher Hills. It came out in 1976, and it's basically, if you could summarize it, it's buy my magic box for $400. That's basically
right, okay.
The gist of the book. And it's really funny because if you're reading through this thing, he's making fun of pyramid power and all these other crazy energy devices of the time, and instead saying, no, you need to buy my P-Ray coffer box. And at the back of the book, there's an order form. And I found a copy of the book today. So he claims this is the most amazing discovery since the pyramid. It's basically a box the size of a bowling ball. You open it up and it kind of goes down like an inverted pyramid. But this, on the inside cover, he tells you what you can do with this magic box. Number one, you can take your ring or pendant and arm it with healthy psychophysical effects. So charge your jewelry. You can create a psychotronic generator which will accumulate orgone and creative vital forces which you can tap when you are feeling down. You can place seeds in it and grow better crops. You can place a wisdom tooth inside it after extraction and have the pain and bleeding stop. Place a leaf of any plant in your garden which you want to grow bigger and watch it outgrow its competitors. You can put your own blood sample in the coffer and watch your moods and energy levels change. You can charge up pebbles and plant them with your favourite flowers. And the final one is awesome. It just says, you can mummify a bird.
What? Why would you do that?
It says, you don't need any professional taxidermist. You can save a ton of money.
Do you need to save money on your taxidermy? Pick up one of these chuff boxes.
It's like, that must have been a big problem in the mid-1970s. You had all these dead animals. You needed to have them taxidermied. It was costing too much. You buy this magical box. You throw the animals in. They come out taxidermied.
I don't know. I never thought taxidermy would have been a big thing, right? I guess it was for...
Well, that's the point of my joke. So, yeah, it wasn't a big thing. So as I was going through, there's all these examples of how you use the box to charge yourself up, and that's where the breasts came in, because apparently if you buy two boxes, you put one on each breast and it makes your breasts bigger.
Oh, my God.
And there's no way over the last 50 years no one's put their dick in that box.
Yeah, well, true, exactly.
That's the first thing I thought of.
Maybe it works in reverse, though. Maybe it just shrinks it down. Maybe it mummifies it. Because if you can taxidermy a bird, what's it going to do to your penis? You know, it's actually funny you should mention about pyramids, because as I was going through Mystery of the Ancients by Eric and Craig Umland, in the first opening chapter, it's like, don't ignore the power of the pyramids, which can mummify any object you put inside. I don't think so. But then they've got all these examples of apparently if you put in a cat into a pyramid in Egypt, you don't have to go through any processes of mummification. It will just automatically happen. And the same thing happens with some of the pyramids that you find in Central America. So he's saying that's about the power of the structure of the pyramid.
Okay.
I don't necessarily know if that's true, but it might be just for the fact that obviously a pyramid is made out of stone and it's a dry, cool environment with a small amount of moisture. So then maybe things will mummify.
That is a good point.
Yeah. So,
well, the other thing that made me think this is a topic worth coming back to maybe on Tuesday's show or next week, is that a lot of these inventors that followed the original guy in the early 1900s, they would make their own devices and they would claim success with healings and agricultural applications. But many of them in the end would ultimately claim that it wasn't the machine that was having the effect, it was them.
What do you mean? It's like some psychic effect.
Yeah. So remember the stories we've covered where, you know, for example, there was one from the 1960s where this person claimed they had a camera that could take images inside a human body.
Yeah.
And eventually they figured out that
it wasn't the camera, it was the guy.
They didn't even need the camera. They could just hold the film and these photos would turn up, and that freaked them out because they realized it wasn't the camera, it was them that was doing it. It seems as though this is the case with radionics, is that eventually people worked out that they were the key to making this thing work. And that's why it couldn't be replicated. Because if you had a device and you gave it to a lab to try and replicate what you were doing, if they didn't have this radionics ability, it wouldn't work. So it's almost like a psychic ability in a way. That's how it eventually panned out if you look at the history of the people that were involved.
It almost sounds like some form of psychic placebo as well. Maybe these people don't realize that they're psychic, but they, you know, it only becomes active through the use of some external apparatus. It's almost like it allows them to focus their energy, which is something that some people that are, you know, claim to be psychic report. They need to have some type of external object to allow them to utilize their ability, such as people that use psychometry, for example.
Well, there's still examples of this stuff being sold today. If you look at you know, Joshua Warren, and he has his wishing machine boxes.
That's right, with the cable sticking out of it. Yeah.
I think if you just Google Joshua Warren wishing machine, you'll see these things. And they're just these really expensive, really nice looking, you know, glossy wooden boxes with all these old school knobs on them.
Practically useless, but
there's nothing in them. There's no electricity. You're just turning knobs. And there's like a metal plate on it that you put your wish on.
What do you mean? You write something down.
I want Ripple Coin to go to $1,000. And then you write that down and you put it on your little wishing box and then you turn the knobs like woo, woo, and then your wish comes true.
Those knobs will be broken off with my wishing and just be constant, you know, constantly moving.
Well, speaking of cryptocurrency, did you see Jesus Coin is launching in a week?
I can't believe that. This is crazy. I mean, we are living, as a complete side note, this is a gold rush of cryptocurrency. If you haven't been keeping on top of this, there's all this stuff which is going on because cryptocurrency with Bitcoin, for example, it's taken off to over $5,000 because more people are beginning to understand it. Even your parents, Ben, were like, oh, can I use Bitcoin? How do I buy it?
That was mostly because I was trying to get them to buy in because I own it. Which is probably not a good idea.
I read today that people are suggesting that, I think it was the guy that bought Snapchat. He believes that crypto or Bitcoin in itself will go to $500,000 by 2030.
It's possible.
Isn't that insane?
I don't know if Jesus Coin will go to $500,000.
I can't actually believe that there is a Jesus Coin. How would that even work?
There's Jesus Coin, there's Car Taxi Coin, there's Sand Coin. Sand Coin's a new one coming out, and it's just so you can buy high quality sand.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. Google it. Sand Coin. I still don't understand why buying sand needs to be on the blockchain. Like,
no.
Why does Jesus need to have a blockchain? Does every religion need a blockchain now?
I have no idea. Although I saw just this afternoon that Korea actually banned the release of new cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, there's no more ICOs. Just following from China. It's all done.
I
think that's really good because
no more Jesus Coin.
No, it means that the existing coins won't be overtaken by silly things like Sand Coin and Jesus Coin.
Buying sand.
It's literally just for buying sand. There's Pawn Coin as well. Also Fuck Coin. Fuck Coin's gone up like 1,000%.
What?
You haven't heard of Fuck Coin?
No, I haven't heard of Fuck Coin. What? What do you use it? Oh, I won't even ask. If you buy sand with sand coin, you know what you're buying fuck coin with. I won't go any further. Well, look, we've kind of derailed. Since you're not doing Radionics today, we'll do that on Tuesday. What have you got coming up? And our Plus extension.
Yeah, well, that's my brain today. I got totally sidetracked. So through Radionics, I eventually made it to this classic book from 1968 called Morning of the Magicians. And in a way, the two are kind of linked because I eventually got into alchemy. And after going through this, I thought this would be a better topic to explore on the show. I think it ties in a little bit with what you're doing. It's this idea of ancient knowledge being kept through secret societies over vast periods of time. And ultimately, I want to tell this story of how one of the co-authors of this book was actually involved with the Nazis' attempt to create an atomic weapon.
Oh.
And just a few years before the end of the war, before they were eventually going to create this weapon, he claims he was approached by a strange individual who, using alchemical terms, seem to understand the implications of nuclear weaponry and warned against it.
Well before, obviously, the scientists understood the implications, like radiation.
Well before radiation was understood, this alchemist understood all of that and more and said that it was a secret that alchemists had known for a very long time but have kept secret because they didn't want it unleashed on humankind. And they were there to warn the Nazis and the Allies to stop.
And yet they were still utilized.
It didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny then, I wonder how that ties in with some of the stuff about the contactee era with, you know, all the contactees or the extraterrestrials coming in saying, you've got to stop using these weapons because you're going to screw your planet. And we can see all the dangers of, you know, nuclear weapons still persisting today, especially with Kim Jong-un wanting to blow up Planet X.
Well, he's doing it for the good of humankind.
All right, well then, let me just jump straight into the book, The Lost City of the Monkey God, A True Story. You may recall we touched on this story back in 2015, actually back when you and I were in Japan, and we were actually talking about the newly released LIDAR results that have come out of some of the surveys that were being conducted over this very, very rugged terrain in Honduras, in Central America. And it all goes back to this expedition, which originally was conducted by Steve Elkins. Now, he's a cinematographer, and he had heard stories about this legend of this lost city. But he'd actually heard it through some friends that were connected and, you know, these little stories that were coming through. But the origins of this story date back far further. We're talking going back about 500 years to where Cortez actually wrote to the emperor and said, I've heard all these quite reliable legends from the locals that there is this city of great riches and it's not too far away and I'm going to seek it out.
Yeah, we just want to visit and
take all the gold.
Take some sketches.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, you know, pillage it and take everything that you can. And, of course, you know, they never found it. They never found it. But all the Indian stories and the native stories that come about it is that this place was inhabited by a group of people or a group of beings that possessed some type of magical abilities that were beyond whatever they possessed at the time.
I don't know if you came across this, but is this the same city that Percy Fawcett was looking for, which he called the Lost City of Z? Is it the same?
No. So I think the Lost City of Z was in the Amazon, whereas this is in Central America. But I guess it's funny because it's very similar in some aspects because that particular region, even with the Amazon, I mean, when you think of the Amazon jungle, you think of this dense terrain where it's going to be very hard to navigate. And of course, it is possible that maybe something could be hidden there. But the region we're talking about here, which is La Mosquita, is this not only very, very dense jungle, it also is incredibly hilly. Like the terrain is incredibly rugged. So it's like going through the Amazon, except having to hike up and down these massive mountains.
Oh, great.
So for potentially a lost civilization to exist there, well, not even a civilization, for a lost evidence of a civilization to exist there is highly possible. And because this jungle, I mean, they're talking about the jungle having a canopy, which is a triple canopy. And if you're actually down on the ground, it's almost like night. That's just how dense and thick this is. And then coupled with that, the dangers of the snakes. So they're highly poisonous, highly aggressive snakes, jaguars, other creatures that may even be unknown to science. And then, of course, you have all of the bugs. So traveling to this region is very inhospitable, but the legend still persisted. But the legends themselves actually described this ancient white city. It was called a white city because it was potentially built of these pillars of possibly white marble or limestone that would glisten from a distance. You could actually see them, and they would sit in this little valley. And no one knew where the valley was, but this was the legend that was coming out. And even Charles Lindbergh himself, the famous aviator, he claimed that he had caught a glimpse of this when he was flying over eastern Honduras back in 1927. So it really fueled the fires, especially back then, for people from the West coming to Honduras and to Central America to find evidence of this lost city. And not only for the sake of archaeology, but also because of the rumors of there being gold and riches and jewels and everything else there. So come to the 1940s, and we have this story of Theodore Maud. And you know, much of the book, which is written by Doug Preston, kind of focuses on the fact that Maud ultimately was this great charlatan. He was this great fraud.
Right.
Because what had happened with Maud is that he had picked up this little canoe and he had traveled into this thick, dense jungle.
When was this?
This is the 1940s. So 1940, in fact, was the year that he did it. It was about April the 6th, I believe, that he headed into the jungle. And he just met with great catastrophe over and over and over again. And there was torrents of water that would come from nowhere, and there would be raging storms, and there would be attacks of insects, and swarms of insects would come from nowhere, and snakes would appear. And even the reports of these snakes, which are still true, I mean, even in Doug's experience, apparently these snakes, unlike Australian snakes, it's kind of funny because I think, you know, when people hear about Australia, I mean, we grew up with snakes. We know that, you know, as long as you leave them alone, for the most part, they'll leave you alone. With these snakes in Honduras, not only will they, you know, spray poison at you or venom, sorry, at you, they will chase after you. Even if you're trying to run away from them, they will come after you. So, of course, Theodore Maud was experiencing this and he kept on traveling and he found a couple of artifacts, but he didn't find anything. But ultimately, after 3 weeks of searching, he gets to a location which he claims is the lost city of the monkey god, or the White City.
Wow.
And he claims in his reports when he came back to New York City, he called this press conference, and all these people swarmed around it. It was this huge fanfare of this discovery that he had made. And in the press conference, he made claims that he had come across a clearing. And in this clearing were these massive steps, these very, very long white steps. And as he walked up these steps, he came to a plaza. And in this plaza, he realized that he was in this legendary city, but there were statues of monkeys everywhere. And at the very center, at the top, at this massive sculpture, like something like a Buddha on the side of a Japanese mountain, was this monkey god. And it was huge. And there were these two mountains that sat behind it. And of course, this caused a huge furor.
And he brought back no evidence.
No, he brought back artifacts. He claims that he found all of these artifacts and he brought these artifacts back. And they were exquisite little trinkets that he had taken from this location. They looked very old and very unique and things that people hadn't seen before. But Douglas Preston, who had actually picked up Maud's journals, claims that this was all a fraud. And what had happened was that after he'd been going through the jungle and he had not found anything and finally had decided to return to New York City after just feeling dejected after this terrible experience, had bought the artifacts at just little vendors along the way and then brought them back and used them as a way to say, well, look what I've found.
It says made in China underneath.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, it was the 1940s. And of course, you know, some people suggest that in 1933 it was a release of King Kong. So the whole concept of there being this monkey god was still in the vernacular. It was in popular culture. It was one of the highest grossing films for the time.
Right.
So for this guy to come back and say that he had found this lost city of a monkey god with a giant monkey statue was truly amazing. But there was this one question that was asked to him. Where is it? And he refused to answer. Now, some people would say, well, of course, he refused to answer because he had no idea where it was because he'd made it up. But others, and I think you may come to a similar kind of conclusion. I'm not trying to sway your opinion here. But others will claim that he didn't want to say where it is because he wanted to go there himself, return himself, to actually go and find the final proof to bring back. But unfortunately, the Second World War intervened and he was never able to return. And he very sadly, he hung himself in inverted commas in 1947.
He was assassinated.
Well, this is the thing, right? So I started looking into his death because whenever someone commits suicide for seemingly no reason, I mean, I know that depression is a terrible illness and it can cause people to do strange things. Mm. But after you've been making these outrageous claims and you've done all this kind of stuff and you might have other interests involved, and you can tell after all the recent research I've been doing about, you know, strange secret societies and whatever else, I went, maybe he didn't commit suicide. And I found this little anecdote that apparently pretty soon after returning from the Honduran jungle, he was mowed down by a car in London and then luckily survived and no one knew who the driver was. I never found them. So it was like this random attack or even a random assassination, attempted assassination upon his life, which he fortunately survived. But then after a couple of years, he suicided himself.
Yeah, this brings memories of the individual who supposedly located or knew the true location of the Golden Library in Ecuador.
Oh, yes, yes.
Who was just assassinated in a cafe just before he was about to return for another expedition to reveal its location.
Yeah. Well, look, just keep that in mind, this potential that maybe there was some other influence that didn't want him to reveal the location of this particular place. And it may not be human. Kind of throw that in for a moment to say that it may not be human, but look, we won't go there yet because let's return to the reasoned scientific investigation.
Great.
By
now there's
Doug
all
Preston.
These expectations of what's going to, what weird, filthy reptilian iguana is going to pop out at the end of this story.
No, there's no reptilians involved. But of course, Doug Preston was fascinated by this. But before he got involved with any of this, there was this cinematographer by the name of Steve Elkins, and he had gone looking for this lost city in 1992, following all of these rumors and the stories that had been coming back. But when he went on his journey, he pretty much experienced the same thing that everyone else had when traveling through this jungle. And he didn't find anything. He ended up becoming a little bit ill and he ended up leaving. But it was enough for him to go, I'm going to go back. And many years later, of course, technology advanced. And by the time it got round to 1998, he tried to go back, but then was hit with some weather problems. And then, of course, LIDAR popped up out of nowhere.
Right.
And this is where he claims that he was working at Jet Propulsion Laboratories at one point. And it's funny because it's this whole case of it's not you know, what you know, it's who you know. And he happened to be just talking to another scientist who was working there. And as this scientist was working there, he just mentioned he was working on this new technology to find an ancient lost city. And straight away he says, well, you have to tell me about it. What are you talking about? And he describes that he was looking for the white city using LIDAR technology.
Wow.
And so he jumped on that. And that's where we come to the story in 2015 when you and I were covering the story back then. So what had happened was is that Doug Preston teamed up with Stephen Elkins. No, I apologize though. But it was Doug Preston was the one working at JPL who got the information. And this is how they all got connected. And they all traveled back to the Honduran jungle with a plane fitted with highly, highly specific LIDAR. It's just an incredible technology. And what the LIDAR is designed to do is that when you fly over a location, even a dense location, such as what you've got with the Honduran jungle and these thick canopies, the infrared beams can actually penetrate down below and even go below the topsoil.
Yeah.
So you can get a really great image according to the data using algorithms as to what might be down there. And of course, it plane flies back and forth like a lawnmower going over a yard. And as it was doing this, one of the expedition, part of the, like, it was 13 guys, one, there was 10 PhDs and three SAS guys that were there with them as they were all sitting there in this Honduran jungle. And they found something. And one of the team comes running into the room and says, there's something here. There's something here. We found it. And they look at the data and they find that there are these strange L-shaped patterns that can only be something that is man-made. There's no way that this could have been created by nature. So they think that they found this lost white city. The problem is it's in such incredibly dense jungle that it's going to be really hard for them to reach. But they hit on this little snag. So Elkins had actually established three different sites that he thought where this might be. And he called them T1, T2, and T3 being targets. And so he finds T1, and T1 is actually where this LIDAR data showed up.
Ah.
So they fly over and they see that even though it's very dense, they're lucky enough that they can get a helicopter in. So they drop the helicopter in and they drop off the team. And they've got this group of guys, including Douglas, who is the author of this book. And they've got this SAS guy with them called Woody. And Woody is a former British SAS, and he's very established at, you know, surviving in jungle regions and whatever else. And they know that they're only a few hundred feet from the location of where this lost city is. But Woody has given them all these warnings about the snakes and about whatever else. And so they have to camp. And he says that this is a few days to actually find this location. But on the very first night, as they're sleeping, Doug is coming out of his tent. And he's moving around the little campsite and he's got his torch. And as he's about to return to his tent, he swings his torch around. And when he does, he comes across one of these feared snakes that he was really worried about running into.
One bite, one kill kind of snake.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, if this snake bites you, you're either going to die from a brain hemorrhage because it will cause the tissue to necrotize inside your brain and it will rupture, or you will die from an infection following it very rapidly. And when you're in the jungle and you can't be evacuated quickly, you're in a little trouble. So he swings across this snake, and this snake is coiled up and poised and ready to jump. And it starts spitting venom at him.
Oh,
this thing has inch-long fangs, and it's just spitting, and it's an aggressive snake. He yells out, and one of the SAS guys comes running out, being true to the name of SAS, and jumps on top of this snake with a stick and pins its head down. So he pins the head of the snake down, grabs the back of the snake and tries to hold the head, which is a standard practice apparently. But the snake is so agile that it's spinning around and manages to turn around, doesn't bite him, but sprays this massive volume, ejects a massive volume of venom down the back of his hand and down his arm.
Oh, no.
But as he's still holding on and trying to hold this thing, apparently Douglas says that as he's watching, where the venom hit his hand, he could see his skin bubbling.
Oh,
this is how potent this stuff is, that his skin starts to bubble and start peeling and tearing apart.
It was like Alien.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, it's not to the point of being acid, but it is very strong. The SAS guy pins it down to the ground and removes its head. The head keeps on spitting acid, and then the body tries to crawl away, which was so strange. Doug said, I've never seen anything like that before. Even though the head was removed, it was almost like there was some... conscious
and
left to the snake.
The head can still bite you after it's been cut off.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So that was his kind of welcome to the jungle experience.
Yeah.
And he knew that, okay, we've got to be really careful. And he was saying that there was this strange kind of effect. Elkins was saying that, oh yeah, I forgot to mention the first time that we had actually come to do this, we were being tracked by jaguars. We were in a canoe, and as they were moving down the water, apparently jaguars were staying along the side. Apparently they don't normally do that, but they were walking along the side of the creek, along the riverway, and tracking them, trying to find where they are. So as you can tell, it's a very inhospitable, dangerous place to be. But, you know, it progresses. And Douglas says that, and this is something that's really important to note, that he was warned about the bugs and about tropical diseases. It's a big problem with tropical diseases, and there's all these different things that can cause problems for you. But as long as they used DEET or DEET, you know, which is the bug spray, essentially, they'll be fine. But he claims that one night when he climbed into his bed, these bugs are so, they're like a grain of sand, but they were everywhere. They were all through his clothing. They were every, and it actually got to the point that the only way he could kill them is by putting them onto a book and then stabbing them with a knife. And that was the only way he could get rid of them. And they just kept on coming. And he said by the end of the trip, he'd actually destroyed the book from stabbing the book so much with this knife.
Nightmare.
It really was. But he kept on spraying his bed, and it eventually ceased, or didn't cease, but it was certainly reduced in whatever bug bites he was getting. But he was covered in them, and this is not fun for him. But fortunately, a couple of days later, they finally wander onto this strange site. And as they do, they see that there's just a couple of what seems to be pots or something just sticking up out of the ground. And they start tearing it apart. Well, I shouldn't say tearing it apart, because they had an archaeologist there who actually put police tape around the whole thing and told them to step back. But they start slowly deconstructing it, and they find that it's this cache that had been placed at the bottom of this pyramid. And they thought it was jungle, but they look up, they realize it's the side of a pyramid of some kind. So they actually find a place. It's not the White City. I mean, they're saying that, oh, well, this is probably the legend of the White City, but there's no monkey god there. There's no monkey god.
Oh, turn around and go home.
Yeah, it's not what Maud was talking about. But he's like, well, Maud was a charlatan, so there's never going to be any monkey god at all. But what's really strange is that they start finding this cache of about, I said it was initially 50 or so objects that were like jars that you could give offerings, like offerings jars, and statues of jaguars and statues of snakes and other strange artifacts. And he said these things have got to be 500, 600, 800 years old. But what's really odd is they're not Mayan. They're not local Indian. They're not any tribe. They were left there or somehow created by a group of people that are now unknown to science. They say there's not even an official name for them.
Lost population.
Yeah, it's really, really strange. But what's odd is that this cache was left like a, almost like an appeasing kind of gift, because all these people vanished suddenly. They just suddenly left, and there's no understanding as to why, and no one knows where they went and why they left this offering to the gods. And it kind of lines up with some of the legends about the White City. Because the old Indian legends was that this city was a tragic city. It was struck down by a series of catastrophes, and the inhabitants, seeing that the gods were angry with them, abandoned the city. And forever after, it became a forbidden place. And anyone who entered it would die of sickness or be killed by a devil.
It's because Jaguar coin crashed their market. And the whole economy collapsed.
That was it. It was all over.
Leave the city.
So, I mean, it was kind of, when I was reading through the book preparing for the show, it was a little bit of a letdown, because I went, oh, well, there's no monkey statue. I mean, God, could there at least be like a statue of a Bigfoot or something? Because some of the native, the legends were, which I was kind of holding back, but some of the legends were that the group that were there were not human. They were Bigfoot hominid
style. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. There was a legend of interbreeding. That's why it was the monkey god.
That's right.
The guardians were the result of inbreeding, or at least that was one of the
legends.
Interpretations of the legends.
Yeah, that apparently that this was inhabited by a very insular group of monkey-type men, powerful monkey-type men that would hunt and attack the local Indians, and all of a sudden they left, and this became a very, very sacred, forbidden place not to enter.
The whole time I thought this was an ancient alien story, but it's actually a Bigfoot story.
Well, not necessarily. And we'll get there. We'll get there in a moment. But it's, as I said, it was kind of like a letdown. But I kept on going through the book because it's still fascinating to find these places. I mean, it's so wonderful to know that in the 21st century, with the developments of technology such as LIDAR and who knows what's going to be around the corner, that there are still these undiscovered locations around the world. There's something really poetically beautiful about it. And so Doug returned back to his home and he was fine. But one of the last warnings he was given is he was told by the SAS guy that, look, when you get home, if you feel unwell in the first few days or so, go to a doctor immediately because there is the risk of tropical diseases. And Doug was covered in bug bites. He said, yeah, that's fine. Now, most of these guys return home, and they're all over the world. Like, they were in Rome, and they're in the UK, and they're in the US, and everywhere you can imagine. And he said he was fine. And he'd had this great experience and he's always been an adventurer. And this is something that he really enjoyed. And he was part of this amazing discovery. But what's a little bit strange is that pretty soon after he had returned home, he was covered in bug bites and most of them cleared up, except for this one. There was this one bug bite that he had on his arm.
Did it turn into a bubble?
No, it didn't turn into a bubble.
A bunch of spiders came out.
No. It was nothing that terrible. But he was a little bit concerned about it. So he went and saw a GP and a number of other doctors, and they kept on saying, look, it's just a bacterial infection. You know, it could be Pseudomonas, could be golden staph. You know,
standard jungle virus.
Yeah.
Put some Windex on it, you'll be fine.
Don't worry about it, you'll be fine. But the problem was, is that the photographer who worked for National Geographic also had this similar bite.
Oh.
But this bite turned into what can only be described as a volcano of oozing pus.
Mm.
This is what it was. It got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Did he start a YouTube channel and squeeze it every day?
Oh, God, I hate those videos. Oh, no. But no, he took a photograph of it because it was, and it's strange because it wasn't necessarily pus either. It was like oozing like a clear plasma type kind of liquid, but it was constantly weeping. And he took a photograph of it, this National Geographic guy who was part of the expedition, and sent it to some of his mates who also worked for National Geographic in some very remote regions who had also worked amongst tropical diseases.
Right.
And straight away, one of his friends emails back and says, that's leishmaniasis. And he's saying, oh, what's that? He's like, you're in a lot of trouble. You need to go and get some help right now. So, of course, this National Geographic photographer calls up Doug and says, look, this is leishmaniasis. And Doug says, oh, what's that? And he's like, we need to get help right now because we're in a lot of trouble. It turns out that indeed they had contracted this parasite. Now, parasites, these are much bigger than a virus or bacteria. But what this parasite is, it's carried in sand flies. And these sand flies are all in this region, this T1 area. And these sand flies, it turns out, are, I think, the reservoir for these parasites.
Right.
But this parasite is incurable.
Oh, no.
It's incurable. Now, so what had happened was they contracted it. And you think, oh, okay, well, they've got this oozing kind of thing that's so
bad.
Get
it out of me!
It gets worse than that because it turns out that this region, what they were in, was a hot zone. It was a hot zone for this particular parasite. And they got in contact with the National Institute of Health. And there's not a lot of, it's really sad when you hear stories like this, but there's not a lot of money being pumped into the cure for this particular parasite because most of the time the people that contract it are peasants. So there's no reason for big pharmaceutical companies to develop vaccines for it or cures for it. Because most of the time it's just poor people dying and who cares about that? You're not going to make money out of it. I'm not saying that, but what the big pharmaceutical companies say about it.
That's business.
That's business, right? So he went to the National Institute of Health that were trying to help them and actually got all of their health care for free because they were so excited that they had come across this tropical virus. But as he sat down, they remove a core out of this hole in his arm.
Ugh.
They analyze it and they say, well, you have the mucosal form. He's saying, well, I don't understand. What is this? Turns out, if you contract this parasite, it starts as a weeping sore, but over many months, if not years, you can have this and not know it, and you can have it for years. So if you've been down into this region, be very careful. It will move through your mucosal layers slowly until it finally gets to your nose and to your lips, and then it will start consuming your nose and lips until they fall off and degrade.
Oh.
And come away. Like Michael Jackson's nose. It'll just come away.
Just pops off one day.
Yep, will just fall off. And so when the Spanish actually got there, back when they're in their conquistador days and their conquering days, they would see these natives with half-missing faces. And they just thought that it was something. They called it white leprosy because they thought it was a form of leprosy. But no, it's this terrible parasite. So the fact that it's incurable is really scary. But fortunately, there are treatments for it. And there's this infusion that you can use. It's a drug which is actually a last line of defense drug, which is used. It was developed for AIDS patients to treat drug infections. The problem with this drug is that when it's infused into you, it's infused over 8 hours. And it is so damaging to your body that it could kill your kidneys.
Oh, my gosh.
And the moment that it starts to be infused into you, it causes a feeling of that you're actually dying and you might go into shock. That's how terrible this thing is. And so
I prefer the face-eating virus.
Yeah, well, it's parasite.
Parasite.
So, yeah. So
how big is it? Is it? Can you see?
You can't see it.
Not a worm or anything.
No, you can't see it. But it is. It's much bigger than a bacteria or a virus. So you've got viruses, which are quite small. Then of course you've got bacteria, and then you've got this parasite. But the way that it works is that when you get some type of foreign invader coming into your body, you have cells that come along like macrophage and whatever else, and they consume whatever the invader is. All well and good if you've got bacteria or, you know, a viral problem or whatever else. But this particular parasite, what it does, it loves to be absorbed by that cell because then it's got somewhere protected to then multiply inside. This is what happens. It all multiplies inside and then it bursts inside the cell. Well, the cell explodes inside you and then it gets into all your other white cells, and this is how it gets into your mucosal layers and you can say goodbye. It's not just your lips and your nose. It's also the roof of your mouth, and you'll get a hole up the side, and it's very, very nasty.
Hold that thought, because we've got sponsors on this show.
Oh, okay.
Let's take a break. Let's hope it's not a food sponsor or anything related after your story.
Or a travel company.
Well, when we come back, we're going to hear if Preston survives.
And keeps his face.
Keeps his face. You're listening to Mysterious Universe. Stay with us. Support for today's show comes from Audible. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more from the leading publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and business information providers. And we love Audible here. We're both members.
Been an Audible listener for years now.
Oh, gosh, they're just milking you for every cent.
No, but it's great because you get a free credit with every month.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
It forces me actually to go in and go, I need to find some good books, and I found some great ones. I find a lot of science and technology ones, but the last one I downloaded was The Princess Diarist, which was Carrie Fisher's last book, and she's so funny. She's really good. It's just a really light, fun kind of book to listen to. Well done.
I was really impressed the other day about the integration with Kindle books.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah, I bought Charles Murray's Death of the West on Kindle, and I'd made it to the third chapter. And then I just so happened to be going on a road trip and had the Audible version as well. So I thought, oh, I'm going to have to find out where I was up to and figure it out. But I just pressed play and it was synced exactly with where I was up to on the Kindle book. And yes, it just continued.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
And it's fantastic because if you've got Amazon Alexa as well, you can actually just get it to play through the Alexa and it will just pick up wherever you've dropped off anywhere else. So if you're, you know, cooking, cleaning, whatever else, you can just ask it to play the book and it will just pick up where you left off.
That's awesome. Audible makes getting more books in your life easy. They've got an unbeatable selection of audiobooks, incredible performances, and you can transform your commute and ride with Audible. Get a free audiobook with a 30-day trial at www.audible.com/mysterious. That's www.audible.com/mysterious, MYSTERIOUS. Visit there for a free audiobook with your 30-day trial.
And we're back. And the good news is that he didn't lose his face or his nose. So he was infused with this substance.
Penis fell off.
Yeah, good point.
Lost his penis. Everything else is fine.
Well, actually, you know, that's kind of strange you should mention that because he doesn't say anything about other parts, but he doesn't, well, you can tell.
No, he sent me a private email and said, totally off the record, my penis fell off.
It's because he put it in one of those radionics machines. He's just blaming it on the parasites. No, so fortunately, he underwent the treatment as well. And he said that, strangely enough, he didn't get any of the effects that come with this vaccine. It's not even a vaccine, this substance, this drug. One of the fellow people he was with actually was exposed to, and he had to be slowed down and sedated because of just how terrible it was for him. But ultimately, it seems like the drug worked. But he now has a lifelong illness that ultimately what happens is this drug, all it does is allows your immune system to kind of get the upper hand. And then for the rest of your life with this parasite, you have it inside you.
Oh.
And it's a constant battle between your immune system and this parasite.
Oh, my gosh.
And of course, you know, you got to be really careful because if it crosses the blood-brain barrier, which it's unlikely to, but if it did, it could lead to serious complications.
So what can he do? Does he just take medication for it?
No, that's it. Like, he's just got to hope his immune system stays up. But he can never have an organ transplant. That's out because you need to have immune-suppressing drugs.
Right.
So he can't do that. And if he ever catches HIV or anything like that, he's pretty much done for because of this disease. So it's pretty horrible, but at the same time, it is something that you can live with.
Well, and he did write a great book.
Well, he did. And look, he's healthy, so don't be too concerned. As long as he, you know, doesn't have to require a transplant or contracts any immune-compromising diseases or whatever else, he'll be fine. And to the point where you can't catch it twice. So he happily returned to go and do more investigations. But the whole story is, and this is where we're going to come back to the mysteries of the ancients with the early spacemen and the Maya. Because some of those other legends, as I said, they spoke about this forbidden place that for anyone who enters it will die of sickness. And this is something which has been reported for a long time. Anyone who went into this region contracted these horrible diseases. And 2/3 of this team contracted this disease. So maybe there is something to the legend. And of course, from a scientific reason standpoint, you can go, well, look, it's a tropical region, and it's not surprising that there are terrible tropical diseases there. But if you're going to go more to the conspiracy side of things, or even to the ancient alien side of things, or, you know, curses or whatever else, maybe there's more to it. Maybe something was purposely left here by someone to act as some type of deterrent to prevent people from getting into it. I'm not saying that, but this is where some of the stuff about the Maya comes from, which I'll go to in a minute. But ultimately, the story kind of ended there for that. I mean, there's still a whole heap more of research to do. There's a whole heap of other archaeologists and ethnobotanists and whatever else that have got to go into this region and uncover something. So there is something there. But in reality, it's not this white city. But as I was going through the
book... Refund, I want my money
back.
Well,
no, because not quite yet. Because as I was going through the book, there was reference to, of course, I mentioned Maud, who was this, you know, journalist who claimed that he had found this monkey god statue. But almost 100 years prior, there was an adventurer, I guess is the way that you would describe him, that actually went into this region as well, seeking this lost city. And oddly enough, while he didn't find the city of the monkey god, he did find this ancient Mayan ruin. His name was John Lloyd Stevens, and he went there on diplomatic reasons, but of course he wasn't going there for diplomacy at all. He was going there to explore. And he came across the city of Copan. And what was really strange is that up until that point, no one believed that there could be any type of civilization in such rugged terrain. This was, as I said, incredibly rugged. There was no belief that there would be anything there. But as he was doing searching, and he actually brought along a friend of his who was sketching and doing paintings, there are these beautiful paintings, and I'll see if I can find some and put them into the show notes so you can see these pictures of Copan that show this incredible city that he came across. But the reason why it was so strange is because while it was identified as Maya, no one knew why it was there. Because normally if you're going to establish some type of city and whatever else with pillars and pyramids and this intricate architecture, you would put it in the lower plains.
Right.
You wouldn't put it into the jungle. No one believed that anyone could get to it. And he bought it for $50 with the idea that he was going to put it all onto barges and then float it back to New York City. But obviously that never came about. And he sadly passed away I've got it in my notes here, in 1852. He too died of malaria. So again, though, it was just maybe this region. What was really strange as well, just a side note about the story as to the disease that was there, the actual Indians that had lived in that region for quite a while, like I think it was Machu Picchu, for example, you don't get leishmaniasis there because leishmaniasis only actually works at lower altitudes.
Right.
And so just this really strange side note that somehow the Indians that built Machu Picchu, or the natives that built Machu Picchu, kind of understood that it was the right location to grow coca leaves, but the right location as well to avoid those tropical diseases. So it demonstrated that there was a kind of understanding of biology even back then. So there was kind of an understanding that then they weren't savages. And this was something that was proven by Stevens. There was kind of a belief that they were just savages. But then he came across this incredible Copan, and it was proven that they weren't. There was this architecture and
no one
sculpture.
Building pyramids as savages.
Of course not. But of course, you know, back in the 1850s, there was this very arrogant belief that, well, it's just savages and they're not capable of creating anything. But the story about Stevens kind of ended there. And I was disappointed. It was like, oh, it's an interesting anecdote that they found this city. And, you know, apart from the fact it was in a remote region.
There's no monkey god. There's no Bigfoot guardians.
No.
The face-eating disease, I mean, his face is fine.
Yeah. Disappointingly. I mean, you know.
And yeah.
Make a better story if his nose fell off. But As I was walking out of the studio this afternoon or coming back in, I picked up Mystery of the Ancients, which I've had, as you said, Ben, for a couple of years. And I've never been able to do it because it didn't line up with anything. The first thing I open up to is a story about Stevens, this guy who 100 years prior to this expedition in the 1850s claims that he found, well, he did, I mean, not claims, he did find the city. The problem was all of his research, according to this book, most of it was accepted because obviously he had proof and paintings and whatever else.
Yeah.
But there was a whole heap of other stories that were included in his works that were dismissed by archaeologists. There are a couple. So there's one story that when he entered into this strange foreign building, he came across a circular building that was about 6 feet high. And when he went inside after finding his way in, he said that in the center of the room was a central pillar with this large, flat, black gloss stone. And somehow, as he moved towards it, it started to glow. And as it started to glow, it seemed to have almost like a static effect to it. Now, he didn't know what it was. And as he stepped back, the thing then shut down. When he moved forward, it kind of lit up and then moved back and it shut down. He claims that this was some type of Mayan communication device or telecommunication device.
What?
That was utilizing these panels of black glass stone.
And it was glowing.
It was glowing as he moved towards it and then shut off as he came back. So a crazy anecdote, which I thought, well, come on, you know, that's a little bit about outrageous. But according to this book, The Mystery of the Ancients, it's because this particular site, which is built in a very rugged region, has all these little things about it which aren't right. First of all the stone that was used to build it had come from distant locations, very distant locations. How on earth did the Mayans get it there? We are talking about mile-high ridges and ranges that they would have had to drag these massive stones over to get there.
Right.
How did they get there? Well, according to Umland, who is the author of the book, now you have to suspend your disbelief for a moment.
Just go all in. Let's just go all in.
The Mayans possessed anti-gravitic aircraft. So when you have places like the Nazca Lines, they were navigation points and aircraft. And this explains why in the jungle they were able to build this particular site. Now, everything was intricately carved. And there's no understanding of how they carved it because you would have required metal tools to do it.
Right.
But there were no metal tools that were found in this location.
Are you going full Von Daniken on me?
There is a bit of Von Daniken included here.
Never go full Von Daniken.
There's a lot of reference to Von Daniken in here as well. So I've tried to avoid that because I know that some of his work has been suspected to be a little bit suspicious. But according to Umland, and this is his story, not mine, he says that the Mayans, the reason why they were in this particular location, and maybe this other strange place, they were trying to keep themselves away from the rest of the population.
Right.
And it's true, they weren't like the Aztecs or the Incas. They weren't like that. There was something very different about the Mayans that we still don't understand. But they seemed to be this peace-loving kind of society that didn't possess weapons, and yet they somehow managed to keep away from the Spaniards. They avoided all of that, but then just suddenly abandoned these cities. They just up and went. But they took everything with them. And Umland says that what happened was, is that the Maya are basically a space-faring group of extraterrestrials that were on a mining mission that started 190 million years ago. And he says, we know this because at least 70 million years ago, there are caves allegedly in this region that have drawings of dinosaurs inside the caves.
Oh, well, if there's caves and there's drawings, you've got me convinced.
So he says what happened was is that the Mayans were this spacefaring mining group. And because you go, well, then why would you go to Earth? Or why would you go anywhere else?
Yeah.
Well, they actually stopped at Planet X first.
Oh.
And when you go through the universe, you might be surprised, but metals are actually a far rarer thing to get hold of. There's plenty of hydrogen, there's plenty of helium, but you've got to wait a long time for everything to consolidate and pressurize and form metals. So these Mayans were looking for mining metal. And what happened was they arrived in our solar system, and when they got here, they found Planet X. They also found the moon, and they also found Earth. Now, the Piri Reis map was made by the Mayans, and it was bought by an 18th century
of course it
explorer,
was.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, according to Umland,
made by the Mayans.
When you look at the Piri Reis map, it's really strange because the way that it looks, it's not of what you would expect the world to be. But it's because it's of the world many, many, many eons ago.
Yeah, we know the Piri race map. Yeah.
The perspective you would have to get only from a very high altitude or space. And well, yet the, somehow
well,
they
the whole thing
that.
With the Piri race map was that it showed the coastline of Antarctica before there was ice there.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Obviously
it was covered by.
It had to have been mapped before, or it was at least copied from an older source that had mapped the coastline before there was ice. So you're going back older than 12,000 years, right?
Yeah, and according to Umland, because the Mayans arrived that far back, they of course were down in Antarctica searching for metal well before the ice sheets took it over. But anyway, we go back. So according to the story, they were mining metal and they actually wanted the core of the moon. So, and it's really strange, right? Because it turns out that the moon doesn't have a metal core. And modern science can't explain as to why. Well, we now know because Umland says that the Mayans took it in a mining operation. But as they were mining and establishing bases all throughout our solar system,
yeah.
They weren't going for the gas giants because there's nothing there. There's no metal. What they wanted was iron. Apparently, iron was far more valuable than what we would consider gold or platinum or whatever else.
Because they come from a planet made of gold.
I don't know where they come from, right? But the claim is that they were working on Planet X, which was this planet that existed just beyond Mars, but they didn't understand. See, the moon is easy to perform the extraction of the core on because apparently they've got advanced technology, but the moon doesn't have weather systems and whatever else to worry about. But as they were working on Planet X, they also were establishing bases on Earth to perform the mining.
Right.
As they were doing that, though, something went wrong on Planet X. And Planet X exploded, killing all of the Mayans performing the mining operations on Planet X. When it exploded,
oh no!
All of this stuff came flying, all these meteorites, and it's like Alderaan blowing up, but it all came flying onto planet Earth, right? And it's really strange because there is this period in our history, in our geological history, where Earth was bombarded with massive amounts of rock that can't be explained.
Right.
Science doesn't know where it came from.
And I knew Planet X was nonsense. This explains it. The Mayans' secret space program actually blew it up. Yeah,
they made a mistake. Apparently it was some intertidal forces or whatever else that they didn't understand. You know, there might be a spacefaring race, but they weren't that smart. They made a mistake. The whole thing blew up.
They needed Bruce Willis there to mine it properly.
Yeah, exactly. So when the whole thing blew up, what had happened was is that the moon, they'd already left the moon and they were on Earth, but unfortunately their cargo ships and extraction ships and whatever else were all on Planet X. So the poor guys that are sitting down on Earth, they can't go home.
Stuck, stranded.
They've only got shuttle vehicles.
How far do they get you?
Around the Earth. You can't leave the Earth.
That's it.
But it's enough to move rock to very isolated locations where you can persist away from civilization. And so according to the story, they then took rock, they used their aerial vehicles, and they built these locations waiting for a rescue group. And apparently they had built or they had taken some type of communications device, such as the large black sheets of stone. There were communication devices using a relay that was left on the moon, which is why all throughout history, before we even went to the moon, there were flashes of red that had been seen on the moon by astronomers. Now, those astronomers claimed that before we actually went to the moon, it was volcanic activity. Now, of course, we know that it wasn't volcanic activity. Now, according to Umland, that was because the relays were being lit up by the Mayas who were left, who were trying to communicate with their homeworld.
This makes so much more sense.
So, while this group was there, the reason why they kept themselves isolated and away from everyone else is because they also carried terrible diseases. So, you have to skip, you know, it's like we're talking about millions of years, right?
Yeah.
But all this happened, he's saying, around 700,000 years ago or so. But apparently, the heating up of the planet because of the triggering of the Ice Age, which came from all those rocks from Planet X. So basically, if the Mayans hadn't blown up Planet X, the Ice Age never would have happened, and therefore the simians wouldn't have evolved into human beings.
Wait, so you're saying the Mayans were here before humans evolved?
Yes, the Mayans were here before humans evolved.
Which is only up until the last Ice Age?
Yes.
So obviously that's not possible. That's bullshit.
So, exactly, I know. But, they're saying there was this... No, so it wasn't the last Ice Age, sorry, it was an Ice Age.
Oh, it's earlier.
It's 700,000 years ago.
It's an earlier Ice Age.
According to the story.
Sorry. Yeah, everything
get it
still
right.
fits.
Yeah,
everything's fine.
Everything's all fine, exactly.
Proceed.
So then, of course, once humanity started evolving, they were concerned about the diseases that we might have, that they might have, that might be spread to us. And oddly enough, as the Mayans did interact with other people, because obviously they'd been here for so long, they seemed to be highly susceptible to things like syphilis and all the New World diseases, whereas the other natives of those regions or the indigenous of those regions weren't so badly affected. So that's his explanation for as to why their biology was slightly different. But they didn't want to release their Andromeda strain upon the Earth. And so, of course, that leishmaniasis, which you would say would come from, well, that's just the evolution. No, according to this, it's possible that that was a parasite that came from the Mayans.
Boom.
That was left in this location, which is now infecting people and taking off their faces.
Have you emailed Douglas Preston to let him know that he actually has a 700 million year old
700,000
Mayan parasite in his brain?
No, I haven't. I should probably just, you know, give him a heads up, a little bit of a warning. But as I was going through, okay, so then it gets a little bit more crazy as I was going through, and I'll link to it in the show notes. I don't even know if there are many copies left, but
so
there are.
One of the first things that Aaron said to me this afternoon when he found this book was, they found a Mayan television.
Yeah.
So tell me that story.
Well, no, that was the start. That's what they found. When the communication device that Stevens found was this Mayan, what he said was a Mayan television. But then Amelin says, no, it was their communication device.
This raises so many more questions. Number one, was it 4K?
Well,
did
no,
it have HDR? What was the refresh rate? What kind of inputs did it have?
What I can tell
was
you,
anything hooked up to it?
According
did
to
they have like a standard video playing, like a demo video?
I don't know. But look, what
like
I can
some
say,
scenery or something.
According to Umland, is that it just involves Jews.
What? What?
So according
of
to...
Of course you have to get the Jews
no,
into
no,
this.
No, 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 this is bad.
It's you. It's you, Aaron Wright. You can't keep it hidden
I'm
for
not
any longer.
I'm saying it. This is terrible. This is a horrible impression of anti-Semitic. No. According to Umland, right? Moses was a Mayan.
Yeah.
And what had happened was the Jews were a group that were connected to the Mayans. They had somehow separated off and had gone to Egypt.
So the Jews are Mayans?
Yes.
Okay.
And they had gone to Egypt, and apparently one of these Mayan televisions was hidden inside one of the temples in Egypt, right?
Oh, right.
And Moses, when he was claiming he was connected to the gods, he wasn't talking to God at all. He was talking to the Mayan Star Command through one of these Mayan telecommunication devices.
Right.
And then that's where they went off into the desert for 40 days and whatever else. But it was all because they were some break-off faction of the Mayans, according to Eric and Craig Umland. It's like, I don't even know when this book was published. I think it's the 1970s, so... Yeah. Yeah. But look, I've got to say, I mean, I'm running a little bit long now. I've got so many tabs in here about all the stories, about why...
Well, it's really great with this book. There's only one review for this. Again, it's a 1975 publication. It's only in paperback, super rare to get. But there is a single review from 2011 from someone basically saying, look, everything's Mayan. That's the best way you can summarize this book. The pyramids of Egypt, Mayans. The Piri Reis map, Mayans. The Bermuda Triangle, Mayans.
Well, yeah, it actually says that. So apparently what happened was when they left so rapidly, because this is a question, right? So what happened to them? Where did they go? Did their emergency, you know, group come back? Did they have ships come back? Did they send a device? And he says, well, look, according to mathematics, and there's pages and pages of mathematics here, that those Mayans that were stuck here, that were survivors, that were abandoned here, they sent a signal back to the Mayan home command that would take... I think it was like 600,000 years to get back. So we're kind of a little bit overdue for them to come back to Earth. But apparently they fled underwater. And so they left this temple that was in eastern Honduras and they fled underwater. And that's why you have all these strange USO reports coming out, because they're not USOs.
Oh.
They are these craft that apparently can live for God knows how long, survive for God knows how long, or could be re-engineered, that are now hiding underwater. And at the very end of the book, the reason why he says it's sinister is because ultimately, when the Mayans come back, they don't give a damn about the species that they created by accident. They want Earth's core, and they're going to take it whether we like it or not.
What do they need our core for?
Because apparently iron is very rare, so they're going to take it from the Earth's core. So the moment that rescue mission arrives, They're going to take the Earth's core and we're all screwed. We're just monkeys to them.
Well, you know, the link to my segment is if they knew our chemical secrets, they could just transmute anything else into the iron that they need.
Well, apparently they haven't gone to that level of effort.
Take the moon. We don't need that. Just take it.
No, no, we need the moon. They've already taken the core.
No, we don't need the moon.
But you think, like, come on, they blew up a planet in our solar system. They took the moon's core. Don't you have enough? You know, you're taking over all the good neighborhoods. What more do you want?
Well, I'm glad you found a completely stupid book to finish the show on. I'm really glad you found that today. So we know the answer to basically any conspiracy is the Mayans. The thing that I was furiously Googling while you were doing that segment, if you saw me typing away on my MacBook here, is I remembered, you know, Corey Good, secret space program, teamed up with David Wilcock, Corey Good,
blue sphere
blue beings. Avians. Basically, this guy, if you haven't heard of Corey Good, he claims that he was a former member of one of the secret, many secret space programs that have been organized by top secret quasi-military black ops groups within the United States. There's several of them. And they're all working together to basically fight evil space, secret space programs. And the, it's all culminating in an alliance of blue sphere avian beings.
Oh, God, we're back here. I would rather believe that the Mayans are, the ancient Mayans are intergalactic Jews than that.
The blue sphere avian beings are coming to save us, according to Corey Good. But the reason I was quickly searching while you were doing your little Mayan thing there is I remembered that there's allegedly a Mayan secret space program. And I'll link to this in the show notes. If you Google Corey Good Mayan space program, if you just want to do a Google image search now, you will see the Mayans with their dumb, smug faces. And Corey has memories of encounters with the Mayan secret space program. And there's a recent post that's come out.
Oh, dear God.
From exopolitics.org, where it's the headline, "Wife of secret space program whistleblower emerges with corroborating eyewitness testimony."
Why do all the aliens look like Mayan burn victims or something? What?
So Corey Good claims he had his encounter with a personnel from the Mayan secret space program who helped him heal from his traumatic memories of being stationed on Mars for the secret American space program.
Was it a Swerdlow level healing?
Yeah, that got it. Yes.
We know what that is.
It was a Turkish bathhouse healing with a lot of hairy men. Some of them Mayan. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, no, no.
She described throwing up her hands. This is his wife speaking of the night that all this happened. And she said, "I'm not seeing this. I don't want to see this." And she turned around and left as she saw the Mayans from the secret space program interfering with Corey Good.
Oh.
So they're claiming that because she's come out and confirmed this tale from her husband, it is now conclusive evidence that there is, in fact, a Mayan secret space program.
Well, look, let's run off a little list. So we've got the faking of the moon landings.
All right, I'll read them out to you because you're the expert on Mayans.
Okay.
So who crashed at Roswell?
Mayans.
Who was Moses?
Mayan.
Okay. Who built the pyramids?
Mayans.
Who did 9/11?
Mayans.
Who killed JFK?
Mayans.
Who sank the Titanic?
Mayans.
Who faked the moon landing?
Mayans.
Who shot Biggie or Tupac?
Mayans.
Who killed Princess Di?
Well, I read that today actually as well, and it might be a little bit strange, but the Mayans.
Who took down flight MH370?
The Mayans.
Who created the AIDS virus?
Mayans. Well, actually, that's the Andromeda strain, maybe.
Who faked the Holocaust?
Mayans.
Oh! Oh, my God. You are unbelievable.
I just walked into that one. No, I'm not saying it. I'm saying this is what the book is saying.
Oh, my God.
It's what the book is saying. I do not believe that the Holocaust was hoaxed at all. It's terrible. What a terrible, horrible thing to subject to. Oh, wow.
All right, one more. Who killed Seth Rich?
Hillary Clinton.
Boom! You're on fire today. 10 out of 10.
Oh, that's not even a conspiracy. Everyone knows that. God.
Someone in a podcast in 30 years will be reading all those conspiracies. That Hillary Clinton is actually a Mayan.
Yeah. I should have said, and Hillary's a Mayan as well. Look, there's a hidden Mayan hand, apparently. We've got to all be very careful because we're going to lose our core.
We'll link to those books in the show notes, and let's just hope that the core remains with us.
For the time being. It's like they're 100,000 years away. We're fine.
Coming up in our Plus extension, alchemy and tales of strange individuals showing up at key moments in history. Moments where weapons of mass destruction were being developed, And supposedly, a secret society of unique individuals had the knowledge of what damage and destruction these weapons would bring and tried to step in to stop it from happening. Ultimately, this connects to the Mayan calendar.
I was going to say, was it the Mayans?
I'm not even joking. This connects to the Mayan calendar. I tried to follow this conspiracy all the way to the end. Ultimately, we end up in Basque territory. You know the Basque people?
As in the Basque separatists?
Yeah, between France and Spain.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where we end up at the end of the Plus extension. I can't even explain how we get there. It's so weird.
Okay, I'm looking forward
to it. It's like sticking your brain into one of those orgone generators.
I'm certainly not putting my penis in there. That's all I can say.
If you want to get access to Plus, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's where we do these big extensions on the end of these shows every single week. They're exclusive to our members. You're going to get another half an hour at least. Usually we do a lot longer than that. And you also get an entirely exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. So if you sign up for Plus, you're getting more than double the content that the free listeners get. And you also get a higher bitrate feed too. We put out a 320 kilobits per second version of the show, the highest quality MP3 that you can get. And you get discounts on our store. There's still a 50% discount available for Plus members if you want to catch some older shows. You get all the ads removed from our podcast as well. Everything's ad-free for our Plus members. And you get all the features of our apps unlocked as well. Don't forget, we have iPhone apps and Android apps available for the podcast. It's all at mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Check it out. It's only $9 a month. Best way to support the show.
Help the Mayans.
Keep us protected from face-eating diseases and Mayans trying to steal the core.
God. I just realized maybe this entire book is just some weird anti-Semitic rhetoric. Because think about it, right? He's saying that they're spreading some horrible diseases. It's almost like saying that Jews poisoned the well. It's the same thing.
Yeah, well, have you looked into that guy?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
Let's find out in Plus.
It's usually, he's probably lurking 4chan right now. MysteriousUniverse.org/plus. Please sign up. When don't blame Aaron for being...
Yeah, please don't. It's the book, not me.
That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Make sure you check out the show notes, mysteriousuniverse.org. Just look for season, what are we up to, 18, episode 13.
Yeah, that's
it. We'll link everything we've spoken about there today and all the books that appear on this show. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. It's too late now, 'cause I'm growing old, but I need you to deal with my sorrow. Just a memory, just a broken frame. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you with us.
You're a bastard.
Why?
You set me up. Yeah.